is important to note is that there's a lot of people who self-identify as information warriors who are seeking explicitly to red pill believers, to convert believers into whatever it is, but in this case, let's just frame it around QAnon, and are iterating ways of being better and better purveyors or convincers or converters of that dogma, acknowledging full well that they don't believe the thing that they're perpetrating.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, our friend Robert Matney joins John and Scoop in the virtual studio to discuss QAnon. The alt-right and the Trump administration have expressed their support for some of QAnon's outrageous conspiracy theories.
Hey, welcome to another episode, or explosive episode, I should say, of the Plutopia News Explosive Network. Our guest today is Robert Matney. Rob is Managing Director of Government Affairs at Yonder, a company that discovers who controls and amplifies narratives across the internet. Yonder uses AI to identify influential groups called factions, making them visible to Yonder's clients. Rob has his finger on the pulse of emerging online narratives, which puts him in a great position to understand conspiracy theories and how they spread. And that's what we want to talk about explosively tonight. So, Rob, how goes it?
It goes well. I'm glad to be back chatting with you all. It's a busy time, what with all the conspiracy theories and other important online discussions that are going on.
What qualifies as the conspiracy du jour? What's really up on your radar?
It all, I think, rolls up to our selected topic. And that, I think, is the, if you will, the strength, although I heavily italicize that, of the selected topic of QAnon. But right now, the plandemic, the conspiracy theory that the pandemic is a plan, certainly there is a video by that name, which is highly problematic from a factual basis. But the conspiracy around the possibility of a plan that created the pandemic is bigger than that particular video that got such purchase for a little while. And the book authored by the putative scientist who was behind that video, her sales, of course, took off. But the conspiracy theory about it being a plan is bigger than that video or that book or that author.
And it's more than one theory, right?
Sure.
More than one contention there.
Yeah. I think the video is notable for being quite vague about which theories it's really purporting, right? It's saying that here's a bunch of possibilities in the video. That, of course, makes it very difficult to refute because they're all just kind of hypotheticals. But and then the way that the planned pandemic intersects with Bill Gates and Fauci, I think that's really the du jour, the intersection of that. And to some significant degree, that all gets sort of slurped up into the omnibus of QAnon.
How do they seem to connect Gates and Fauci? That's a strange connection. Is there anything even vaguely realistic in the theory?
I know the answer to that. Fauci uses Windows.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, I think we're all guilty then. We better just head to Guantanamo and turn ourselves in.
There are claims out there that he served on the Gates Foundation board, which definitely does not appear to be true according to public records. There are claims that Fauci and Gates both stand to profit in some way from remdesivir, which is the I think if I'm remembering right, the medical facts right, the existing antiviral that may supply some relief from the acute symptoms of COVID-19. But I mean, the connections between the two are not really very strong. They appear to roll up, you know, into both think vaccinations at a global scale are really good for civilization and humanity, which, you know, from my perspective is an incontestable fact. I mean, not that all vaccines have been rolled out perfectly or that all vaccines are perfect, but as a genre, vaccines have done quite a lot for humanity. And certainly Fauci and Gates have a long career of supporting the development of vaccines to support global human health. That's about as far as any actual connection seems to be. And everything else that I've tracked is, you know, inaccurate information that is based on very little.
Yeah, this whole thing about conspiracy theories used to be, it was kind of fun, you know, we were somewhat ironic about conspiracy theories like 30 years ago. When I was doing Fringeware, we talked about conspiracy theories a lot, but we really didn't take them that seriously, at least I didn't. And it seems that something must have happened in, I think, around 2016 that caused conspiracy theories to somehow carry more weight and be weaponized in ways that we had not seen before.
Yeah.
I'm just pegging that on 2016, and I'm trying to think what happened that year.
The presidential seal of approval was stamped upon all conspiracy theories.
Oh, right. Donald Trump was elected that year, wasn't he? So can we, in your opinion, Rob, can we attribute much of the active weaponization of conspiracy theories to the fact that the president himself tends to, well, at least pretend to believe, if not actually believe, the conspiracy theories and weaponize them himself?
Maybe. I think if attributable, it would only be partially attributable. I mean, I'll just say generally, anytime global leaders are endorsing theories, then they are, by virtue of their office or their position, going to then add weight and add credence to the conspiracy theory. So I don't think it's controversial to say that any world leader, in particular a world power world leader, signing on to an idea is going to give it credence. And I think we have to remember that also during this same time frame, we have seen the meteoric rise of the quantity of media we're able to consume. We have seen the continued disintegration of gatekeepers of truth keeping. Just generally, I think the public at large is less and less ready to say that any particular entity is a reliable, credible purveyor of truth. And I think those crevices allow room for, you know, demagoguery to really take root. So I guess to be more succinct with my answer, I think that the fact that leaders are now endorsing conspiracy theories is a big piece of it, and it's only part of the puzzle. The other part of the puzzle is the fact that collectively we appear to have decided that there are no reliable gatekeepers of truthfulness, including scientific consensus, which I think is a fairly recent disintegration in terms of, you know, the last two or three years
I think there's always been a kind of anti-intellectual streak that's run through the discourse in the USA, at least. I mean, I was reading about anti-intellectualism in America, you know, decades ago. So it's always kind of been there. And there have always been people who sort of created their own reality in their heads and would readily share that, but they didn't really have a platform for sharing like they have now.
It's so easy now to create a website or any kind of social media site that looks really authentic, looks really official and impressive, that people can be easily fooled by that. It used to be really hard to create that sort of thing, but now the tools are so widespread.
Yeah, well said. That, yes. So this fragmentation and disintermediation of our information ecosystem is that other side of the coin, right? We have people who are leveraging it, but we also have a context where things can be leveraged. And that disintermediation, that ability to easily produce polished-looking publications, indeed, polished-looking publications that can pretend to have a specific provenance, but then deeply obscure their provenance by making opaque, like, you know, where the domain was registered and who it was registered by, et cetera. I mean, that is the milieu of the problem. And there's this term, fifth generation warfare, that probably you all are familiar with. I don't remember all of how generations 1 through 4 track, but generation 5 tracks is information warfare. There's a lot of people who are cynically and conscientiously engaged as information warriors. And I think something about this speaks to what John was talking about a moment ago, which is the idea that you know, conspiracy theories were at some point engaged with in a way that was satirical, self-aware, not really buying into it, but certainly alert to it, playful about it, even maybe even trolling with it. I'm putting that word into your mouth maybe a little irresponsibly, but I'm not trying to say that what you were doing then was off or wrong or problematic, but observing that there's this line where you can use information and be playful with it, and then at some point you can become aware, oh, we can play with it now not in a benign way, but in a malignant way. And the thing that is important to note is that there's a lot of people who self-identify as information warriors who are seeking explicitly to red pill believers, to convert believers into whatever it is, but in this case, let's just frame it around QAnon, and are iterating ways of being better and better purveyors or convincers or converters of that dogma, acknowledging full well that they don't believe the thing that they're perpetrating. So, you know, if my commitment, for example, is white supremacy, I might leverage another narrative in order to convince someone of something that moves them towards white supremacy, right? And that it is a cynical leveraging as a fifth generation information warrior. Once that person is red-pilled, now they're adjacent to white supremacy, you can move them in, now they're part of the fold, and if you've really done your job well, you can convince them to go convince other people, because now they're a believer in the core ideology, which is not at first the explicit ideology that gets put out there. And there is at least some halo of some percentage around QAnon that is definitely engaging in this. They don't actually think that there's a kind of quasi-mystical mission from God that's being fulfilled by an administration and a set of mystical drops that are actually leading us towards the future where we all go together. In fact, they're just trying to get people to really question their own incumbent notions and come back with answers that are closer to whatever's the driving motivation of those people.
People look at QAnon as either a cult, and some even think it's trying to emerge as a religion. And I did a lot of, in my early journalism days, studies of cults, the Moonies, and various other self-help groups. And one of their strategies was to target specific celebrities and are important people, because once you have them into the fold, then you draw their fans and friends in. And do you see that kind of thing continuing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think cultivation of key people. I mean, I came across a 4chan thread recently where the focus was, there was a TikTok video, and the TikTok video was a young woman who was talking about her nationalistic sensibilities, her U.S. nationalism sensibilities. And the dialogue in the 4chan thread was, this is a win. She's a young woman who exhibits certain traits, including in their description, physical beauty. And if we can leverage this video and her as a spokesperson, we can convince others. Well, it's hard to call her a celebrity. She's just a person on TikTok making videos. But that idea of, let's pick the people that have more rhetorical value because they're going to be more persuasive, whether it's through their physical beauty or through their persuasive powers or through their political powers, I think knowing who to recruit as an asset is part of sort of total information warfare,
So they would be more likely to recruit someone that looks like Angelina Jolie rather than someone that looks like Scoop Sweeney.
Yeah, indeed. That's right. And we're saying it in as many words. That wasn't implicit. This is who we need to get if we're going to get our message out to the groups that don't yet have our message. And so it was a very explicit, planned campaign. You know, to another point that you made, Scoop, that I think is right, is this kind of, where does it align with mystical implications? And I think, you know, there's maybe two levels deep here that I see, where one is, is the conspiracy theory sufficiently Rorschach'd, sufficiently abstracted with kind of error in the system, so that I, as a potential believer, can project my own idiosyncrasies and beliefs into it, so that what I get is me staring back at me and can say, yes, that conspiracy theory understands me, or it encompasses me. And I find myself at home in it, right? So, there's probably a better way of terming it, but being sufficiently Rorschach-y is a quality of a successful conspiracy theory. But then I think there's an elevated level above that that gives me great concern, in particular when we think about QAnon, because I think the QAnon has at least the potential, if not the practice, of being of manifesting this, which is a kind of religiosity. If you can connect the conspiracy theory not only to some ancient incumbent conspiracy theory, but if you can connect it also to some sort of mythology that verges or engages with the supernatural, you've got the making of religious devotion. You've got the making of a cult that is the kind of thing that can really move human zealotry. You know, though I'm certainly alert to John's friend Mike Godwin and my own friend, and his observations that other people frame as cautionary tales about comparing to Hitler or the Third Reich, I'm reminded of the Third Reich's appropriation of the book, and I may get the title a little bit wrong, but the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a book that framed the struggle against the Jewish people in terms of present and ancient religiosity. And that was one input. There were other inputs, although I hardly consider myself an expert on the topic. But there was a number of inputs into the conspiracy theory around Jewish people as the root of all ills, not merely a scapegoat, but the root of present and historical ills for the German people. There was an invitation for religiosity that I think has to help explain part of the fervor and absolute commitment to destruction that came there. So when I think about QAnon and its absurdities, one of them is that it invites a certain kind of mystical religiosity. It's found itself aligned with, you know, a kind of dominionist Christianity that's bringing about a certain kind of end time where the certain right people will get their final justice. And it's not just, it doesn't merely rhyme with the book of Revelation. You know, it manifests it in certain ways. And I think when you can get humans to act in a way that is rooted in religious belief around conspiracy theories, and you're really dealing with things that are dangerous on a global scale.
That sounds strangely familiar. There's another cult, Washington, D.C., I think is the headquarters, that encompasses a lot of that cultishness, the religiosity, the godsend of Trump. You get a lot of that of people. Trump was sent by God to save the nation. And if that's not scary, I don't know what is.
Well, you know, I read a book recently, you may be familiar with it, by Andrew Marantz. It's called Antisocial Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation.
Gosh, that sounds like a book I should read, John, but I don't yet know it. Thank you.
Oh, you should. Yes, I'll send you a link. He sort of embedded himself with the emerging alt-right people. And one of the things I got from that book is that it doesn't feel like they were completely serious about what they were doing. It felt more like a kind of opportunism, you know? And my thought is that some of the people who generate these conspiracy theories, if not all of them, are really doing it with a political strategy in mind or some strategy in mind. They're fairly crass about it. It's not like they believe what they're saying. They're just creating a kind of narrative that will serve their ends. And I wonder about Q. I mean, Q is completely anonymous, right? Nobody knows who Q is. Some people suspect they know. For instance, I was reading a book about QAnon where they were trying to make the case that Q is actually Donald Trump. And it could be. I mean, you know, when he's not busy tweeting, he could be creating drops. But if it is Donald Trump or whoever it is, you might imagine that they're using Q strategically and politically to try to gain and steer power.
Yeah, I think that's right. Gain and steer power, I think that's right. I think, and I do believe that it's almost certainly cynical. And this is more intuitive than data driven, so I'll just acknowledge it, but that limitation. But I think also there is an explicit effort with this tethering of the QAnon narratives to the Fauci Gates narratives and the planned pandemic narratives. I think there's a real conscientious effort to kind of bend the horseshoe of political discourse with the extreme far left who have a skepticism of the narratives that are forwarded by historically by the center of the spectrum or by the establishment. Combine them with the far right, who are also skeptical of the narratives, and kind of bend the horseshoe so that there is a common ground betwixt the farthest left and the farthest right. And if that bending is able to achieve success, you can then theoretically have a voting block of some substance that wouldn't kind of yank the Overton window left or right, but rather yank it to that end of kind of fundamental skepticism. And that, as a possibility, opens up at least another fifth generation warfare, information warrior motivation, which is folks who are cynically in it not to further a worldview, but just to burn it all down, right? Like, just to say, if I can assemble the absolute wing nuts on the left and the absolute wing nuts on the right, then we might just kind of break the back of everything and then have to start over from scratch. And from where I sit, that looks good, right? And so there is the motivation available, which is just trying to destroy the fundamentals of the civilization.
Yeah, just breed chaos and division until the whole thing blows up.
Yeah, what confuses me is the Trump administration's seeming love of QAnon and virulent hate of Antifa.
It's hard, right? I mean, there certainly is a combination of the anti-vaxxer crowd. That's getting consolidated in. But that is not the same as an Antifa crowd. I think that there's some difficult bedfellows there in terms of the Antifa crowd is going to feature no small proportion of people of color, and that will be fundamentally anathema to a lot of people that are being courted. And so I think that's a difficult place to bend the horseshoe is just along ethnic lines. So I think that's probably part of that equation. But, if you can convince the group who is skeptical of the dominant MO to just become more skeptical about vaccinations, then they're closer to what you need. And so I think it's probably not so much a we don't want them as a we don't want them right now.
Well, part of the reason that, well, one obvious reason that someone would be opposed to Antifa, since they're anti-fascist, would be that they're fascists. Fascists would naturally oppose Antifa. Yeah. But it also, there's a strategic gain in trying to paint them as an organization and a dangerous organization that is coming from the left, even though I'm not sure they're exactly coming from the left. And the other thing is, there is no Antifa. There's no organization. There's no actual group of people. But if you can posit a group of people and point to them, if you can say, there's these guys over here and they're bad guys, you know, that creates a kind of rhetorical weapon that you can use to rile people up and to get them kind of upset about it. But meanwhile, Antifa just is like, it's more of a strategy. It's more of an attitude. It's not like there's a bunch of people who have a building they go into every day and sign up. You know, they punch their Antifa card as they walk through the door. But one thing about Antifa that I think really creates a problem for people on the right and people who have what you might call fascist leanings is that they've made it clear that they're not going to be peaceful and nonviolent, that they will meet violence with violence. And that is probably scary for somebody who is sort of generally thinks of the left as being sort of lame and or liberals. You know, they call them libtards, and they assume that liberals are going to be basically a liberal is going to be a wuss, that he's just going to lay down for him, you know, that they're going to be able to stomp on him. That's not true with Antifa. You don't stomp on Antifa without getting stomped back. At least that's the attitude of Antifa that I understand.
Well, there's a trend in QAnon of some fairly violent actions that I was reading through the Wikipedia listing of some really dedicated followers who show up with guns and shoot places up, and you know, because they believe they have immunity from the Trump administration, and that's kind of scary. And they had a photograph of a SWAT officer greeting Vice President Pence, and the SWAT officer has a Q emblem right in the middle of his flak jacket. So that's kind of scary as well.
Yeah, and another thing I think that will kind of embolden people, those semiotics, those signs are meaningful. You know, one of the things that I think is playing into the discourse around Antifa, and John, I'm taking your point to heart about it not really being an organization, right? And then also taking to heart the, you know, the fundamental, it appears to be a group collected loosely by the idea that fascism is a bad idea.
I should clarify it. It's not an organization in the U.S. There is actually an Antifa organization, I think, in Germany.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
I believe that's the case.
I wonder if there is an intentional conflation, perhaps an unintentional conflation, between Red Guards and Antifa. Where Red Guards are a little more organized, they're a little more specific, and they do oftentimes appear in the same place, and Red Guards specifically collect and address their sort of social structures around Marxist, Leninist, Maoist principles. And I think, you know, that, of course, is red meat, right? I mean, if you can make the enemy a Marxist, Leninist, Maoist, it seems like historically a fairly easy win politically in the U.S. And I'm not really sure why. Maybe it's just because the Red Guards actually aren't that significant in number, but you see a lot of people who are happy to say, yeah, of course I'm anti-fascist, so I'm happy to have that sign. But the various trappings that go along with being a Red Guard, that's actually a much smaller group. But I think that, you know, there's a way in which the public discourse's received notion of Antifa may be the received notion of the Red Guards.
Is there a Red Guard in the U.S.?
Oh yeah, in many cities within, and I myself was at a particular protest, and there was a Red Guard group there that was very active, and I'm certainly no expert on them, but I can report that in that protest they were exceedingly actively antagonistic to the police force that was there, ostensibly to keep peace between the protest and the counter protest. I think there might be a notion of that. And I think that probably there's a particular mask that the Red Guards often wear. And I think that has kind of become a sense of Antifa in our public discourse.
The origin of all of this, I think, is just in a kind of uncertainty and discomfort with what's happening in the world. And there is an inherent human need to find meaning and to feel some sense that you kind of can understand your world. And if it's hard to understand your world, then you kind of would be more open to accepting the offering of some kind of narrative that would somehow work. So when we were growing up, there was a sort of mass media narrative that was fairly well, you know, centralized and vetted and held to be a kind of truth that people could adhere to, especially like post-World War II. There was a strong sense that people really understood where they stood, you know, understood what was happening. And that has been eroded over time, and particularly now, and especially during this pandemic. I mean, it was bad enough, as I mentioned, in 2016, when we had someone who took a position of leadership that was more about being divisive and more about spreading misinformation and comfortable, you know, lying and comfortable spreading conspiracy theories. That's a big problem. And it certainly started, it created an atmosphere or an environment where this kind of stuff could really, problematic conspiracy theories could take hold, and all kinds of extremes could sort of rise to the surface and you know, start bubbling up and using their narratives to gain some degree of a following and a power. And then the pandemic happened. And during the pandemic, we really do feel so much anxiety and so much uncertainty about the world and our place in it. And, you know, not even sure that we're going to live to see next week, because if we step out, if we step into the wrong context, we may be infected and we may get sick and we may die, or we may have some kind of really egregious illness that will take us down for months, if not kill us. So I can kind of understand what's going on with people now. I don't really know how to fix it. But I think you do, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a complex problem. But I think it's a good segue to thinking smartly about what can be solutions. It's going to be difficult to cover ground to establish highly credible truth sources in society across the short term, right? I mean, that's a momentous task. And I don't know that it can be achieved quickly. So I think raising awareness of the manipulation tactics that are there, I think that's one tactic. But I also think engaging with the obviously cynical warriors and calling them out and engaging in their own tactics. For example, recently K-pop super fans, many of them who congregate on TikTok, but who here were participating in Twitter, just massively hashtag bombed the various hashtags that are associated with QAnon. QAnon and WWG1, WGA, where we go one, the law, right? It amounted to a kind of socially engineered DDoS attack on the conversational space, right? And it was so fantastically extraordinary, so successful, that people who were waiting for their dose of information, their hit of QAnon, because that was how they had allocated that time in their day, were interrupted because suddenly what was trending was a bunch of those hashtags was a bunch of content that was completely off topic, was just, people dancing and doing their thing. And there was an extraordinary, I don't know that I have it, but there was an extraordinary article in Media Matters, I think, that featured posts by, I want to say, a Mike Rothschild, but I'm not sure, who was carefully cataloging the ways that QAnon, either believers or cynical propagators, were just absolutely freaking out about this hashtag bombing they were getting from this massively coordinated effort coming from fans of K-pop. And of course, they were attributing the massive bombing to other groups. Yes.
QAnon followers melt down after K-pop fans take over their hashtags.
Yes, yeah. And it's a fantastic chronicle. And so, I'm reminded, again, referencing Nazi and Third Reich, I'm reminded of the follow-on with the resurgence of the KKK. I'm reminded of the ways that the comic book Superman co-opted the KKK into the narrative and made them objects of ridicule. And I feel like one way out of this is to just explicitly, within the context of great art, just openly, rightly, forthrightly make QAnon believers and propagators the objects of derisive ridicule that isn't just like they're bad, but it's like they're foolish and ridiculous.
Acknowledging that it's a culture war and meet it with artifacts of culture.
Well,
through art, I think. Yes,
The K-pop fans also did quite a number on Trump's Tulsa rally, getting us, all the K-pop fans, to sign up saying they're going to be there. That's where that million person figure came from, and it was a bit less.
Yeah, who knew that K-pop was going to become a political force in the USA?
2020 is a series of surprises, I think we can all agree.
Really, man.
Well, I love the concept. My approach a lot of times is just to use humor against stupid stuff, because just sitting there and calling it stupid doesn't really accomplish much. But if you can make them appear stupid, then it's a little more enjoyable to me anyway.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's one of the tools that we have available to us, is just revealing the absurdity for what it is.
Dad, you got to think about who you're really talking to as well. It's like if I contradict somebody who's making the argument that, Fauci mentioned today that focusing on the number of COVID deaths is a false narrative, because really the concern is not how many people are dying. Obviously, people are concerned about people dying, but from a public health perspective, the real concern is overwhelming hospitals. So it's cases, it's not deaths that they're concerned with. But there are a set of people who are set on opening up, as they say, opening up the U.S., opening up the economy. And they keep making the argument that deaths are going down. And if you argue with those people, you're not going to get anywhere with them. It's a strategy for them, and they're just going to keep saying the same thing. But if you argue with those people in public, like on Facebook or wherever, other people are going to see what you're posting. So that's your audience, really. People who are, kind of not, they're not they're not using information in a way that's weaponized, or they're not trying to achieve some strategic end, but they're also, they're kind of not sure what they think. And you really help them to think it through and understand what's happening. So with that in mind, I have kept, you know, persistently responding to people who have that particular narrative in mind, you know, or who follow that narrative thrust, and which I think is misleading. And I'm constantly correcting them, and it doesn't do any good. They keep coming back and saying the same thing over and over again. But I know that other people are paying attention, and they're saying, oh, yeah.
That's well said. The audience online is always more than the you and the interlocutor, you as interlocutor and the other person. It's always the people who are also nearby.
Yeah, what we used to call lurkers.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there's always the lurkers.
It occurs to me that this whole QAnon thing is a perfect target for governmental troll farms who want to really disrupt what's going on in this country. And I would imagine that's a good portion of what you're seeing on the QAnon posters. It's not just, you know, American crazies. I think there's some, from reading through some of those posts, they seem, some of them seem identical. And that's usually a sign of troll postings from the troll farms overseas. Have you seen any of that?
I mean, it can be a sign, right? And so that sort of similarity scoring, it happens amongst groups operating online all over the world, including foreign adversarial groups, for sure. And one of the things that, it's part of what you said, and I just want to make it really explicit, is that it is decidedly not the primary MO. Even going back to early 2016, it is not the MO for it to be bot farms or botnets that are replicating precisely identical content. It is much more the MO to be accounts that are hybrid accounts, partly automated and partly staffed by humans. Using tools that make it easier to scale. And so that's one part of the MO. And two, more than ever, more than in 2015, it is also the MO to not originate content, but rather to opportunistically amplify content. So it's harder to get away with, it's easier to detect and therefore harder to get away with groups that originate content. It is both harder to detect, and it appears more effective to opportunistically leverage the backbreaking narratives that are already out there. And if possible, play both sides of it so that it splits. And that is the kind of international adversarial foreign state information warfare playbook. And it is definitely getting played, for sure.
So the challenge is to find the messages that fit your strategy and amplify them.
That's right. Run a bunch of complex search queries, return the ones that are the juicy items that you think will either play to your desired foreign policy narratives, or separately ones that will just be destructive, and then amplify those. And another part of the playbook is to play both sides of it in reliable patterns. So for example, kind of super covert accounts that are not attributable to a power might, and often do, say, hey, Here's this conspiracy that's happening. It's all around us. The global elite is causing a problem in a specific way, whatever is the conspiracy theory that matters there. Whilst having the state media, the state-run media, say, look at those stupid people who believe all those conspiracy theories. And so you sort of get your cake and eat it too in this MO, right? And so that's a play that's definitely being played, and it's regularly being played.
Well, there's so much more that we can say about this. We're kind of running out of time. What do you think? What do you think we have ahead of us as far as the emergence of conspiracy theories? Do you think that people are getting wise to them and that they're starting to have less of an impact, or do you think that they're going to continue to morph and mutate, and that we're just going to see more of them?
Right now, the QAnon conspiracy theory is pretty influential. It's pretty effective. And so it has not, in my observation, shown signs of abating yet. I think it will abate. I mean, I'm kind of a fundamentally optimistic person, so I think this fever does break, but it doesn't show signs of breaking yet, at least not in anywhere that I've seen. So, I mean, I think we're going to see this. I think probably it's going to amp up through the rest of the year. And it's my hope that then the fever breaks and we see the kind of, you know, almost like it's a, you know, tulip mania, like this period where we just couldn't agree about anything passes. And this frenzied hunting for anything to give us meaning goes away. I don't know. This period of massive quarantining, I hope that where it's possible, where lives and their circumstances permitted, that we take opportunities to wrestle with the existential dread that's a condition of human life, and then by so doing, need to run less enthusiastically towards ridiculous narratives that don't have any substance past the immediate surface. I hope.
I think there's cycles, you know, historically there's cycles where you have something kind of like a mass hysteria where people go a little bit crazy for a while. And then when it's over, they look at what they had done and what they had thought, and they say, shoot, was that me? I believe that?
I hope that's right. I think that's right. I'll point out that, one, I'm deeply heartened by the way the public position has moved so dramatically in the last 6 months, that we do increasingly appear to agree collectively that there is a very dramatic problem with police brutality affecting our Black community. And yes, something needs to be done to fix that. Like the polling is so clear, the opinion has moved. We agree that's a problem, and we've got to put a stop to it. We don't all agree about how or what's the best way, et cetera, but mostly, by and by, we agree that it's a problem that has got to be fixed. So I'm really heartened by that movement that movement in people's positions and beliefs. So I'm hoping that is a precursor of us getting away from this weird frenzy. And there was a meme that went by recently that I think is relevant here, and it said something like Fox News has turned our parents into what they thought video games would turn us into. And it was a picture of the folks with guns, right? And I feel like there is a corollary, the meme that could be made that hasn't been made to my knowledge, which is that the people who were so worried about what the impact of, let's call it, moral relativism, less fervent religious orthodoxy, that the people were so worried about what that would do to other people, but what we see is what it's done to them, right? The degradation of central truth tellers has absolutely freaked them the hell out, right? And I think that that's part of it. And I think that's a generational issue. And I think we can look optimistically to our younger generations to not inherit the fever.
This entire conversation has made me really wistful for the oldie but goodie conspiracy theories like cattle mutilation cults and the government is damaging our vital fluids by putting fluoride in the water. Boy, those were the days, huh?
Yeah, or what was the wearing aluminum foil on your head, right?
Oh, yeah, tinfoil hats.
I keep a tinfoil hat here in the studio at all times. You never know who you're going to encounter.
I want that to be true, Scoop. Please tell me that's true.
Well, that whole thing went downhill when they started using aluminum instead of tin.
That was the turning point. That's when we no longer block the EMF waves.
Yeah, it didn't seem to work for the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz anyway.
Absolutely, the 5G conspiracy is the direct inheritor. The 5G conspiracy around coronavirus is the direct inheritor of the old tinfoil hat, EMG casing around your head.
Well,
and incidentally, the Gates Fauci is the direct inheritor of the global Jewish conspiracy, and also the adrenochrome conspiracy is the direct inheritor of the ancient blood libel conspiracy. And it's weird. They have these descendants I'm taking it off track.
I'm waiting for some enterprising roofing company to come up with tinfoil roofs for all the people who live around 5G towers. I may go into that business myself.
Well considered.
Well, Rob, thanks for joining us again. And I think you're joining us again next week.
Yeah, I can't wait. And with my buddy, Bejoy, I can't wait.
Yeah, that'll be a blast. Okay, man, thanks.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. We'll see you soon.
Rob will join the Plutopia podcast next week with Bejoy Goswami to further explore conspiracies and cults. You can follow Robert Matney on Twitter as @RMatney. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.